Welcome to the Designing Hollywood podcast in association with the John Campia Show. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. Today's episode is sponsored by Paris Costumes International. Today's guest is brilliant Spanish Oscar-nominated costume designer Paco Delgado, who grew up on the Canary Islands, where he cultivated a vivid eye for color, shape, and texture. That aesthetic, developed at the Institute of Theater of Barcelona, has served him well. In 2011, he collaborated with the famously meticulous director Pedro Almodovar on the BAFTA award-winning film The Skin I Live In, which, oh my God, what an incredible movie. Delgado then earned an Oscar nomination for Les Miserables and The Danish Girl. Most recently, he dressed up mainstream Hollywood entertainments like The Jungle Cruise, for which he fashioned Dwayne Johnson's instantly memorable riverboat captain outfit. He recently finished work on John Wick 4, but none of these projects exceeded the breadth and depth of sartorial splendor showcased in Death on the Nile. Based on Agatha Christie's 1937 mystery, he and his team spent a year researching, designing, dyeing, cutting, and fabricating some 150 outfits for delivery in the fall of 2019 when filmmakers shot Death on the Nile in England's Longcross Studios and in Morocco. Speaking from his home in Madrid, he compares Gal Gadot to 1930s movie star Carol Lombard and reveals himself to be something of a method designer. Great-looking clothes mean nothing unless they reflect the character's motivations. He firmly believes all people have a very powerful tool to express themselves at their disposal: clothing. He feels these visual statements can be as strong and as emotionally stirring as the words they choose to say. Without further ado, it is my tremendous pleasure to welcome costume designer Paco Delgado to the Designing Hollywood podcast. Mr. Delgado, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really overwhelmed about what you have said about me. I do what I can do.
Well, let me, I need to ask you, like we were talking earlier just now before the show, and you said you grew up, when you were growing up in the Canary Islands, that you were a fan of B-movies and all kinds of cinema. What were some of your early cinematic influences?
Well, I mean, you know, I got to say the really, really first cinema influences were my grandmother used to live near a sort of like a small repertoire cinema. And in summer, I used to go to sleep with her and in her house. And in the summer, she kept the windows open, and the cinema, the local cinema, kept the windows open too. And then I remember, like, really, really vividly, and I'm very, very, it used to be very exciting to hear all the westerns and the conversations on the screen that we could hear from bed when we were like trying to sleep. Then that was super, super magical. I thought, you know, a little bit like cinema paradise. So, you know, I mean, it really, really was happening to me. And that was the beginning, I think, of some sort of like interest in this sort of like world. And then I don't know, I mean, I suppose to happen to a lot of people of my generation that, you know, cinema was a very important thing. And I remember my parents used to have this house in the countryside and we used to go all the weekends, but I really remember me and my brother crying, like, we want to get back to our city because we didn't want to lose the matinees on Sunday's afternoon and watch, you know, all these amazing like westerns, like Italian westerns, spaghetti westerns, and all these peplums, like, you know, I remember a series called of a Roman hero called Masiste, and, you know, like really, really, I don't know. I mean, all that made like my wish to be part of this world, I suppose.
Now, did you see yourself as getting into costume design? Was that something that you were interested in as a young man?
No, really. I mean, the thing is, I used to be a fairly good student and fairly good at sciences. Then I think myself, and I suppose if you're very good at maths, then your family, your your teachers, you know, yourself, you try to think, oh, you know, let's try, you know, let's take advantage of this opportunity. And I wanted to go to university and study physics, and I did so. But at the same time, I was always very interested in theater and amateur theater. And then the whole thing started growing and growing and growing. And then I realized, well, I'm not a good actor. It might be better that I do something, you know, like behind the scenes or something. And I went to the Institute del Teatro in Barcelona because I wanted to become a set designer. And I think my career has been like a series of how do you say, like a strikes of luck, really, because I never understood how, with very little experience and with no, I used to draw when I was young quite a lot, but I didn't have like a sort of like a proper artistic sort of like studies in a way. And then I always think, how is it possible that I went to the Instituto del Teatro, that it was a very famous theater institution in Barcelona, really old, like hundreds of years. And I did the examination tests to be admitted, and I was. What it was, like, really fascinating, you know. I always think, how is it possible? Who I could cheat, you know?
And well, the Spanish, I mean, the Spanish industry. So once you were at university, were you studying things like art history? I mean, a lot of the costume designers I've spoken to do have pretty rigorous academic backgrounds. Were you suddenly, did you just dive into all kinds of studies of artistic history, or was it theater and cinema only? How did that happen for you?
Well, it was, I mean, the thing is, the studies were like basically theater and art related, you know, performing arts. I didn't have like sort of like lectures on history or, but I always was very interested in history, and especially in art, contemporary art. It's, you know, I used to be very, very interested in contemporary art. And well, we have a country that with a really, really, also really, really rich art history, you know, then I suppose, like, you know, I mean, I used to love to go to museums like Prado Museum or, you know, things like that. And, you know, I mean, I suppose that was the beginning, to be honest. But I think always, this sort of like thing from my childhood, these influences of this early matinees and this very magical thing that I was saying, that when I was a child and I went to bed into my granny's house, and I could hear this, the sessions. I remember, like, they used to show a lot of like spaghetti westerns, and they were like, you know, the whole night, like, listening to people getting killed and all these sort of things.
Well, how did you find? So you're in university, and you're studying these things. How did you find yourself becoming involved in the actual film industry there in Barcelona or the rest of Spain?
Well, I mean, as I said, you know, I mean, I did my studies, and then I finished with very little sort of like practical experience, because the studies in Spain used to be, you know, not anymore, but then they used to be very, very theoretical and very little practice. And then I had a friend, I finished in Barcelona, and then I had a friend, an actress, that she used to work in commercial theater in Madrid. And she told me, well, I mean, I'm working with this director and his set designer and costume designer, and maybe you should call them and ask them if they have any sort of like open position for you in any of his shows. And again, I don't know why I was like, you know, I mean, because I suppose like everyone, I always find very, very hard to call people and say, well, listen, do you have any job for me? But I suppose I was very young and I had nothing to lose. And then I called them and they said to me, well, that was maybe, I think it was like a Friday. And they said to me, well, could you be in Madrid on Monday and show us your drawings? And, you know, and we have a chat and you tell us what interests you in theater, what interests you in cinema. And then I just, you know, I just imagine I was like, I don't know, I mean, I might be like 21 or 22 or 23, and I just like run and put a portfolio together really unprofessionally. And then I just like, you know, met them, and they like, I suppose they like more than they like my work, they like me maybe. And they gave me like a job as a runner. And then I started working with them, and that was it, really, basically. You know, I started working in commercial theater in Madrid, and then I heard, well, it was a very famous sort of like very off the track school in London called Motley Theatre Design Course, that it was run by a woman called Percy Harris, that she was a really, really old lady. And she used to work with John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier.
Wow.
And was part of, it was an institution in the English theater. And she was one of the founders of the Royal Court. And again, she had this school that she got like 10 students every year. And I just thought, well, why? Well, I could try. I mean, you know, I mean, I always have been very naive that way. I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe I have an opportunity. And then I just went to London, made a interview with her and other professors, the teachers of this school. And I had really, really, really little knowledge of English then. And another miracle happened, and I don't know why they took me up. and then I started studying in London with them, and you know, they were like, these people were pretty amazing, because you know, the whole stories they have to, you know, for example, Percy used to say, Peter Ustinov was such a naughty child because she knew his parents, that they were like Russian emigres, that they were part of the theater Moscow school, and then they came to England as emigres, like you know, like fleeing from the revolution, and then, you know, she had this all like first hand not only theater knowledge, but also all these little gossipings, and you know, I mean, I remember she said to me once, I remember I went to the opening of the Spectre of the Rose, you know, Nijinsky. And she said to me, Nijinsky was a great dancer, but the costumes were awful. And the costumes were Leonbaxed, you know, that is considered like one of the, but because she was audience at the time, she had a critical opinion of the costumes, not really thinking that it was a major icon of costume designers, Leon Baxt. Then it was like, you know, it was like really, it was that really, really was really important, I think, in my life, and really, really interesting.
Absolutely. Well, you've had a pretty, your rise in the industry has been pretty spectacular, and you've had an opportunity to work with some great people. I mean, in Spain, you work with two of my favorite directors. You work with Alex de la Iglesia and of course Pedro Almodovar, whose films I've been watching for so long. I mean, what, 40 years now? And how did you find yourself working with those two directors?
Well, the thing is, I started working in cinema, but again, by one of those, well, I suppose like everyone, by the chance you have a friend that says they are looking for runners for this movie, and why don't you come along? I introduce you to the designer, and you know, blah, 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 blah. Then I went, I met the designer, I got a job. Then I started like working with this designer that she's called Sonia Grandi. She's a great designer and works with Woody Allen and many people. And then I started working with her and with another designer as well as assistant. And I did my first movie with Alex because I was assisting another designer called Lala Huete, that she was designing a movie called Muertos de Risa, Death of Laughter. I don't know how it was translated into English. And we were all very young, and Alex was very young as well. And I think we just saw like clipped together. And in the next movie, he called me instead of calling the designer I used to work for. And I thought, oh my God, because she's a good friend of mine. I thought Lala is not going to talk to me anymore, but we're still very, very good friends. And then I started working with him. I did a movie called La Comunidad. I think, I don't know how it's called in English.
I just know it as that. Yeah.
And it was a movie with a very, very little budget. I think we just like shot for maybe 6 weeks. And I remember I had a prepping of 4 weeks maybe. And it was like, you know, I mean, I had a lot of fun and misery as well, because, you know, movies are like a roller coaster of emotions sometimes. And I don't know, at the beginning I didn't used to like cinema as a worker, because I, as I said, I came from the theater as well, and I used to find cinema very, very complicated, very sort of like harsh and everything quick and people screaming and a lot of like stress. And because Alex used to scream a lot. I mean, I suppose now he has tamed with age, but he had a lot of temperament and you know, very Spanish. And then I finished this first movie and I thought, well, you know, this is an experience. I think it has been all right, but I don't want to come back to this. And then suddenly, little by little, you know, you forget all the bad moments and just remember the good ones. And then, you know, I mean, movies are like a drug, really. You know, cinema is like, it really hooks you. I think it hooks you or repels you forever. But, you know, in my case, it was a huge, you know, I mean, it really hooked me. I really felt that it was a very interesting job from the artistic side. And I always like to tell stories. And I think that was movies obviously are a great way to tell stories, and also a good way to work in community with other people and share the same interests and working together and being together in the nice moments and in the bad moments. You know, I just, you know, it was, I don't know, I just felt that it was like something I could do well.
Well, I mean, I have to say you do it well. And, you know, I love the work that you did. Like The Skin I Live In was also Bad Education. The work you did with Almodovar was amazing. And working your way up, did you ever think, coming from the theater, that you would do the movie version of Les Miserables? Because my God.
No, because also I'm going to be quite honest. I don't like musicals. I've done a few of them. I like some musicals. For example, I love West Side Story, but definitely Les Mis wasn't a musical I really liked then. Now I like it because, well, it's part of my life as well. And after you have been in a project for a whole year, listening to the music, like, you know, like a in the background of your mind constantly, you end up like loving it. No, the thing is, as I said, I never have expected anything. It's just like, I think most of the things have happened in my life because I was in the right place at the right moment, you know? I mean, it happened with Tom Hooper that, you know, that was, that he came to Spain to do a very long commercial with Captain Morgan, and then it happens that if you are working in Spain and you have worked, for example, with Almodovar, every director that comes into the country wants to interview you because, you know, they know the director, and a lot of them, Pedro is a very appreciated director, I think, mainly international, even more than in Spain, perhaps. Hmm. And I had an interview with him, and then he called me for the job. And then we saw like clip. We had a very, very good relationship working. And then he said to me, well, I'm doing this big movie for, I think it was Universal. It was Universal. I'm doing this big movie for Universal. And maybe maybe you would be interested in it. And I just thought, well, this is a typical thing that you are having good time with a director, then he disappears from your life or from the movie or from the work you're doing, and next time you see him in a pub in London, he doesn't even remember your name or your face, you know. Well, yeah, because you know, this is the things that happens a lot. And then I just like I was with my partner then the other time, and I got this phone call from the States, and I thought, how weird. At the beginning, I didn't want to take it up because I thought, how weird, somebody calling me from the States, because I didn't have then any international career at all. But then I finally picked up the phone, and they said, well, you know, we are calling you because on behalf of Tom Hooper, because he will be very interested to know if you have any interest of doing this movie with us, and maybe you are up for an interview. We are interviewing other people, but maybe you will be interested in it. And yeah, then I did it, and the interview was, I went to London. The interview wasn't going very, very well. It wasn't a little bit like that, but one of the producers, that it was Cameron McIntosh, that is, he has the rights, I think he had the rights, or then at least, of the musical, asked me, you speak fairly good English. Why is that? And I said, well, you know, because I study here in London with this lady called Percy Harris, and the school is more, and he said, and after that, he obviously knew Percy very well. He said to everyone in the meeting, well, this is one of the best theater designers schools here in London. And then after that, the whole interview took another, I don't know how to say in English, rumbo, like, you know, another way. And they said, the job is yours. I went to a Chinese restaurant to have some lunch. And I thought I was going back to Madrid, yes, and they will call me at some point. And before I finished the lunch in Chinatown, they just called me and said, Paco, you got the job.
I love the fact that you're a man who doesn't like musicals, and yet you worked on both Les Miserables and Cats, which are two of the biggest musicals of all time.
Yeah, we're very different luck in both of them. One was a big hit and the other one was a big flop. Then, you know.
Yeah, but your work was great in both.
Yeah.
I mean, your stuff was great.
I always say in the same way that I don't believe a lot of when people come and say you did a great job and the reviews are amazing, I never believe it completely. In the same way, I don't believe when people say you did a shit, you know, I think it's a good trait of my personality that I don't like the streams of adulation or the deprecation. You know, I think, you know, both movies were interested in a way, and both movies have faults, and for me they are important in my career because I always see every job is a way to develop as an artist or as a costume designer or as a worker in the industry, then, you know.
Well, then you found yourself getting nominations for Academy Awards. What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know what to say. It's just like the first time it was it wasn't unexpected because, as you know, you get in the Hollywood Reporter and everywhere, it's like the possible nominations of the year. And I didn't follow any of those things, but I had always friends like, you know, I just read that your work in Les Mis might be, is really appreciated, and maybe you get a nomination. And I never paid any attention because I was thinking, well, that's so completely stupid. And the thing is, it also, I mean, I suppose if you have a career in Hollywood, or you have had a career in Hollywood, or you are from LA, or even if you are from, I don't know, from Calabasas or whatever, or right, from Orange County, I mean, you have much more so like I don't know, more opportunities, or you see the whole thing closer to you. But as I said, you know, I am a person from a very small island, working in Madrid at the time, working internationally. I started to work internationally, but it wasn't yet sinking into my mind. And then when I got nominated, it was like a really strange feeling, because on one side, I felt wow, on another side, I thought, why is this happening to me? It's like, do I deserve this? You know.
Of course you do. Yes, you did.
Well, no, I don't know, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, right? Of course.
I felt like super overwhelmed, and then you know, I obviously you do. You do your. I remember Judiana Makovsky. I went to a meeting in one of the meetings of the Costume Designers Guild, and Judiana Makovsky told me, if they nominate you, it's really bad because you have to spend a lot of money for clothes and for different things. And I was like, okay, well, then better that they don't nominate me. And and then I got the nomination. And then, you know, it was fun. It was especially the first time was like, you know, I mean, you felt yourself that you were like living like a tale, you know, like a sort of fairy tale.
Well, then you came to America and you worked for M. Night Shyamalan on both Split and Glass, two movies I quite enjoyed. You know, that those are both Blumhouse films, and I guess in a way, which kind of in a way led you to Disney, because Glass, it was Unbreakable was the first film in that series, and yeah. And then you worked for Ana DuVernay on A Wrinkle in Time, which also had some beautiful costume work, and that was also a Disney film, and you found yourself working on two big Hollywood movies. You were Jungle Cruise with a Spanish director, right?
Yes.
And a great guy. Great guy. Jama's great guy. And and then you were working on Death on the Nile with Kenneth Branagh directing. I mean, so you had these two monstrous projects. I guess let's start with Jungle Cruise. I mean, obviously based on a ride, I've got to ask you. Before you started working on it, did you go to Disneyland and ride on the Jungle Cruise ride?
Well, I don't know if Disney is going to like this, but the answer is no.
Have you ever been on the Jungle Cruise ride?
Yeah, I have been after, but not before. The thing is, at the time, I think Disney was trying to rethink the ride. Because the ride had sort of like, it was one of the I think it was the first ride or one of the first rides in the
park.
The most successful one, or at least during a long time. But I think it was aging not in the right way, maybe, some of it.
Right.
And you know, I mean, it has like some sort of like visions about people living in the jungle and things like that. They were like a little bit up, you know, out of date.
Yes.
And not very politically correct. Then I think, you know, that was one of the main reasons that Disney wanted to create this franchise or this movie, you know. And it was a lot of fun because Jaume is, I want to say, an adorable director, a really great person. Really easy to work with him, very encouraging and very, 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 very super talented. And it was very nice to be working in the States with a Spanish director. We could communicate in our language. It was like, I had a lot of fun. It was like a really, really fun project to do.
Now, I mean, a great cast, obviously one of the big movie stars in the world right now, Dwayne Johnson, and of course, Emily Blunt, who coming back and playing Mary Poppins. So she was obviously somebody Disney loved. How did you begin? How does one start making clothes for a man as large as Dwayne Johnson? How do you begin? What did you do? What was the inspiration for his riverboat captain for you?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I normally try to, I always say that one of the most amazing things about my job is they pay me to learn. It's like people have to, a lot of people have to pay, or mostly everyone has to pay for the education, but as people who work in the industry, they pay you for research. They pay you to learn things, to get into new worlds, to, and I find this is amazing. Then, you know, I mean, when I was reading, obviously when you read a script, I suppose it happens to everyone. I read everything like almost like with a blank mind, and I leave my mind to go everywhere. You know, it's like the same way when you are reading a novel, and you, if the novel is very well written or is getting to you, you are capable of feeling what the smells of the streets will be, and what the temperatures will be, and what if the atmosphere will be full of a smoke or cigarettes. So, you know, you start thinking a lot of not just the look of everything, but also sensations. And when I was reading Jungle Cruise, I mean, I always had in my mind, and I suppose it was part of the whole thing, I had African Queen and Mogambo always in my mind. Mm. I don't know. I mean, it came like really, really naturally, and the whole iconography came from both of them, you know. I mean, I have to say quite proudly that I copied the looks from Humphrey Bogart in Queen of Africa, nearly up to the T.
Sure.
And Emily is dressed like, I would say 95% like Ava Gardner in Mogambo. You know, I mean, I just saw Ava Gardner in a green shirt blouse in the jungle, and I thought, this is it. And then the DOP, that is a really, really great friend of mine and of Chauma as well, he was like, but how do you dare to dress somebody green in the jungle? It's already green. This is not going to work.
Sure it is. It'll work fine. And it did, by the way. It worked great.
Yeah, because I thought, if it worked in Mogambo, why it's not going to work here? And I thought it was a great color for her as well. And I also, I mean, I hate when you get in movies and people think that you have to contrast with the background. So, you know, that you have to wear like another different, this is a very, for me, a very old fashioned way to work colors in cinema and in costumes. I just thought, well, you know, it's much better that she's part of the jungle herself. You know, I mean, she's green, the jungle is green, then, you know, you can sort of like mimetize and sort of like establish some sort of like connections, you know. And I think it worked. I mean, you know, I mean, I hope so.
Did Dwayne Johnson like being, did you like it looking like the new, the modern Humphrey Bogart?
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, you know, I didn't have any problem with him at all. I mean, he embraced the costumes from the very, very beginning, and his agent and everyone really liked them. It was like a love at the first. You know, yeah, it was like.
Oh, he looked great. I mean,
I watched the movie and I think sometimes that some of his suspenders.
Right.
Suspenders, they are like a little bit too bright. So one pair that he was wearing is like a little too yellow, I think. And but that's because I'm very critical with myself. And I was like, you know, look at, I'm always very unsatisfied with my work in movies. I always criticize myself quite. The only movie I haven't criticized myself is a really tiny movie, but really wonderful, that I did back in Spain after years working abroad, called based on Snow White, called Blancanieves, and it's a black and white movie, silent. Mm. And that's the only movie I had. It opens in San Sebastian Film Festival, and I went to the premiere, and I completely forgot that I was a costume designer. And it really, really sort of like, you know, I mean, it was wonderful to see one of your jobs and being capable of I forget completely that you did it, you know.
Well, then, I mean, a movie that just leapt off the screen, the costume design was just sumptuous. And that was, of course, Kenneth Branagh's second Agatha Christie mystery, Death on the Nile, with an amazing cast, Kenneth Branagh directing again. Those costumes were amazing. I mean, that you talked about in an interview that you believed in method designing, that the costumes should bring the characters to sort of life as much as the actors do. And I think you really nailed it. And how you had a huge team developing those costumes, and you were looking at old Hollywood and you were looking at old designers and Paris Vogues. How did you begin the process of creating the costumes for Death on the Nile?
Well, I think because I always start with a script. Maybe because I again, coming back to what I was speaking before, I started with this lady called Percy Harris, that she was a really, really big believer on the text, and the story that you have to tell is you know, I mean, has to be based a lot in the scripts. Then I started reading the scripts, and then I started having feelings again, and then I just thought the period was the period that Kenneth wanted to set the movie was a little bit later than the novel itself. He wanted to set it up in 1937, that is just a couple of years before the Second World War, and it's a really interesting moment in fashion, because most of the fashion that it was being developed at the point got so like truncated, you can say, like got cutted.
Yeah,
by the war.
Yes.
And then it was like a really sort of like a strange period that didn't develop completely and properly. Then I started getting fascinated by that. A lot of the silhouettes already looked very, very 40s. And I thought that was super interesting. And also I just thought that at that time, you know, I mean, you might say nowadays or young people are fascinated maybe with singers, with, you know, with pop singers or with models, but at that time the big fascination was Hollywood and the star system. Then I just thought, you know, I mean, if you are rich at the time and you really want to portray yourself like you are amazing, and some of them are really sort of like they are not. They were not people, not all of them were people with all money. What is like another type of aesthetic? They were like a lot of like, you know, newcomers and people who inherited money or people who lost money, because the whole story is based on sexual attraction and the wish to have money, you know, and greed. Then it's like, you know, I just thought it really looked to me like very easy to think in Hollywood at the time. And Kenneth wanted to make a movie. He said to me, I want to make a movie that is obviously period, but it doesn't look like period in the way that, you know, I don't want to have people with heavy, I want you to find what in the period was really, will you say, depurated, like, you know, like clean lines and then that was the point of departure. And then I just thought Carol Lombard will be interesting for Gal Gadot, and she really loved the idea, because again, it's one of those things that you think, and then she said to me, well, that's really funny you're telling me, because I was having lunch or dinner or something with Francis Ford Coppola the other day, and he said to me that I reminded him of Carol Lombard, and it was like, you know, and I was like, well, if Coppola told you that, then I think this is it. We have to follow it. and then, yeah, I mean, I and everyone, I was trying to find, because this is an ensemble cast, all working together all the time, of people that of a certain level, like, you know, like a spoil, what we say today is spoil rich brats or something like that, you know, people who never have work, never have had any problem. Some of them have real problems, but they pretend they don't. And then I just thought, you know, it will be very interesting to sort of like develop every character from the point of view of the costumes, and that was my main aim, you know, just how the costumes can show people. And I like to work sometimes by going on the contrary. And for example, I just thought, for example, the two main women characters, you know, Lynette and Jacqueline de Beaufort. I just thought it seems like the one who is the strong one is Gal's character, but in fact, the strong one is the other one because she is consumed by jealousy and love, and that's such a powerful sort of like leitmotif to carry on in life, just revenge. And then I thought, you know, I mean, she has to look always like much more passionate and much more strong than Lynette. Well, Lynette is like this sort of like little flower all the time in these coarse pastels and whites and creams and silks, and then the other one is always red and sort of like, you know, fierce. Then I started building these two characters, and then the other characters started sort of like developing by themselves, you know, in contrast or in association with these two.
The costumes are just, they're absolutely incredible. Now, did you have a large team of people creating these costumes? Because you built everything from scratch, right?
Yeah. We built everything. I mean, this movie was hard to make in the sense that it was a lot of work, but it was so much fun. I mean, I will really always keep in my memory a movie like this. We have a sort of like fairly good size, I would say, workroom. Maybe we were in total, maybe, I don't know. Sometimes I think we were like 50, 60 people perhaps. And we were like doing everything, like, you know, like obviously all the cutting and the sewing, but then dyeing the fabrics. Most of the fabrics we started with fabrics in cream or white, and we dyed them in the colors we wanted, and the people embroidering. And I mean, it was like people painting on fabrics. It was like we had a millionaire, two millionaires on site. And I don't know, it was one of those movies that, you know, they don't come so often, but I mean, I had the luck to do this one, I suppose. I had a lot of fun, really.
You have a great eye for color. And, you know, I think probably that's why you work with Almodovar, because color is so important to his films. How did you sort of develop your color palette, the rich palette you use in your clothing? Where do you think that came from? Because it couldn't have just been you said how, you know, you were lucky to get these jobs, but you got these jobs because of your talent. And where do you think your love of color or the use of color in your work came from?
Well, I always think that all my aesthetic comes from my island. I always think that it has to do with my childhood. And the island I'm from is a volcanic island. It's basically black. Mm. All the sand is black, like black ashes, like very similar to what you could find in Hawaii. And then the sky is like really, really super blue. And it's very, very little vegetation. But then here and there, you know, you see like a plant with a red flower. And in contrast with the black, it makes a very sort of like dramatic impact. And I think it comes from that. I don't know.
That makes perfect sense to me. I never would have thought about that, but absolutely. Because it really comes through. And now in the movie, Gal Gadot wears the 128 carat yellow Tiffany diamond. Is it true? Is it true that was on loan from Tiffany?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's true that the diamond was from Tiffany, but it was a replica, basically.
Okay.
Because
you mean they wouldn't give you a 128 carat diamond for the movie?
No, I mean I think we had it for some photographs or some sort like. But I mean, it would be like, imagine working with a diamond of those characteristics. No. It was already quite hard. That Tiffany was really, really super helpful, and they made two or three replicas of this diamond, this collar with a diamond for us to use, and they lent me a lot of like real pieces from their archives, like, you know. And it was quite amazing, but at the same time, it's scary because you were like working with pieces that, you know, I mean, they have a story in themselves, not only just 1930s, not only just the 1930s bracelet, but the bracelet that maybe, I don't know, Gary Cooper bought to his wife. And then, because Tiffany what they do is like they try to rebuy some of the iconic pieces from their customers, and especially if they have belonged to rich people. I mean, you know, if somebody inherits a piece, then they do a bid for it because they want to. They have a really amazing archive,
right?
And then, you know, it was like, I mean, it was funny because, for example, somebody like Annette Bening, she thought it was so overwhelming to wear all this real jewelry that she said to me, Paco, if you don't mind, I think I prefer to wear like replicas because then I don't need, yeah, because the thing is, if you wore one of those authentic things, you have always with you somebody from Tiffany following you on the set when you were coming out of set, always like really worried that you were going to rub the diamond bangles
the wrong way, yeah.
They were going to scratch the diamonds, you know. It was like, then, you know, I mean, for example, somebody so amazing like Annette was like, you know, I mean, I think I prefer not to wear them. Let's do some replicas, and then, you know, I can feel free to be myself, you know.
Did you have a favorite of all the things you made for Death on the Nile? Did you have something that was your favorite?
Well, it was like, it was really funny because every week that we produced, I can't remember how many costumes per week, but every week we used to say, this is the best we have made so far. And then the following week, we did another thing completely different, and we thought again, oh no, this is much better than the one we did last week. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, because the characters were so different. I mean, you know, because Gal was dressed in a style. For Gal, I really love the dress we made, the chiffon dress that she wears in her wedding. It's a very simple dress, but it took us like a long, long, long time to get it right. And for Emma, that she played Jacqueline, I really like the first dress when she is dancing in the club. And I loved all the costumes of Rosalie. Waterborne,
beautiful,
because it was like very flamboyant and it was a lot of fun, and Sophie Oconetto is an amazing character herself, and so she just embraced the clothes so much, and she was always very happy to. She was always like waiting to find what was the next number for her. You know, it was like it was very exciting working. Oh, it was exciting working for everyone. It was such a nice ensemble cast. I have only good memories from them because sometimes you work in movies and you get some tough cookies here and there, but you know, right. In this case, it wasn't like that. It was like a really, really, really enjoyable cast to work with. And I think you can see that in costumes.
Oh, it absolutely comes through in the movie and the costumes as well. I mean, it leaps off the screen how much fun you all must have been having. But speaking of fun, you did a movie after that with Pedro Pascal and the great Nicolas Cage. You did Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Now, how much fun was that movie to do?
Well, I mean, that movie it was a very simple movie, or it looks like a very simple, but it was really hard to make because we did it in full pandemic in when, you know, I mean, we did in 2020. We started in summer in Hungary. We saw like a gap of, but it seems like COVID is receding. I think it's the end of it. Let's go to Hungary to do this movie. And then we ended up in Hungary. And as soon as we got there, the whole thing escalated back again, like the famous second wave. And we ended up, like, you know, working with almost everything shut, shops closed. We had to buy everything over the internet, but because it wasn't that many flights at the time, because most of the air communication was cut down. You know, anything that you order, I mean, you know, we had to order fabrics and everything on the internet, and I wasn't very used to that at the time, because, you know, I mean, I always like to work feeling things in my hands. I'm very tactile, and I like to see how things look, not only how they look, how they feel, how they move, and that was quite hard to do. But also it wasn't not only that, it wasn't just like normally if you order something on the internet, you can have it in 2 days or 1 day, and at that time the quickest was 1 week. Then it was interesting, but it was hard as well. But then, I mean, you know, again, Nicolas Cage is an amazing character himself. It's just, you know, I mean, bigger than life itself. And we had a lot of fun with him. And you know, it was good.
It was good. Now, I guess to wrap up.
I mean, I have a very varied career. You know, I mean, I cannot say I have a gender. I think I have done nearly everything.
Oh, you have. I mean, I like the fact that you've worked on so many diverse kinds of films, you know, whether they're musicals, whether they're mysteries, whether you're wrapping somebody up in gauze, like in The Skin I Live In, you know, so they have to walk around like they're in Eyes Without a Face. I mean, you've really done it all. Now, I would be remiss, you have coming up John Wick 4. Now, you know, the John Wick series sort of came out of nowhere to become a huge success. And I want to ask you, you know, you came in on the fourth movie of that franchise. And one of the interesting things about the John Wick franchise is the world in which it takes place. It takes place in a very different kind of a heightened world, you know, and of international intrigue and mystery, and everybody's beautiful suits are bulletproof. So when you came on to John Wick 4, how much freedom did you have to sort of design all of the, because again, all these great actors, all these great characters that you're designing for, whether it's, you know, what was it like for you to come on to John Wick 4, the fourth movie in a franchise?
Well, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay,
we can
see you. My image is frozen, and I thought maybe you couldn't hear me.
Oh, I can hear you.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I had worked with Chad before.
The director.
With the director. Sorry, with Chad Staszelski, and he called me to do this movie, and I was like, I thought, well, you know, it's another different genre that I haven't done before, like, you know, movies with a lot of action, like a really, really highly action movie. And I thought it was very interesting to try to be faithful to the saga, because obviously it's, you know, I just came with a character that it was already developed, and you know, I always insisted in this fact, no? You know, when I was having all the fittings with Keanu, I was always like asking him, what do you think? What do you think? Is this John Wick? Is this the John Wick you are used to? Because, I mean, I didn't think I need to invent anything. I mean,
right.
The saga was already very, very successful. And in a case like that, you have to be quite humble and and decide that what you have to do is do be a continuation of the work that the other designers have made before, then. But the thing is, I think, you know, I mean, I hope I brought my style into it, and because I mean this is not the first time I work with a person with a project that already has a very prefixed style. I mean, when you work with Pedro Almodovar, you are already walking in a world,
right,
that has been pre-established. I mean, you know, you have very little, you have to, I think it's interesting to work in projects where you have to work in a really narrow path, you know, that you can, it's not like an open field. It's just like a path that you already has been traced, and you have to know how to walk in it and develop a story or a look from it. And I don't know, I mean, I hope we had a lot of fun because part of this movie was supposed to be happening in Japan.
Oh, really? Part of the movie is set in Japan?
Yes. Well, you know, the whole movie has already like a very, very philosophy, like a Eastern sort of like philosophy based in the samurai code. And then, you know, it was very interesting to try to develop a world that it was a real world, but it had a tiny bit of fantasy. You know, I mean, I don't know how to say how it was. It was like I always wanted in the movie to portray something that it was believable from the point of view of reality, but it had this sort of like bias. And I think Japan is very good for that, because I don't know if you know Japan, but you go to Japan and it's a very strange feeling, because in one side, you think they're so close to us, is so many elements of the Western world, but at the same time, they are so far away from us because they have nothing to do with us in a way, culturally. But at the same time, very, very close. And I think that's already a sort of like a meta language or a meta thinking, you know, I mean, that you already are working in two different levels, the level of reality, the one you recognize as really close to you, like everyone or mostly everyone is dressing or in westernized costumes, and they use cars, and they are highly, you know, like the technology is like really sort of like westernized, or we have our technology is very Easternized. I don't know how to say it, but
right. No, I understand.
But then at the same time, you know, they have all these traditions, and they still have their sort of like a really, really close world where honor and family and traditions really, really matter. Things that we have sort of like almost the soul of their society is like still very vibrant. That I think in the Western world we have abandoned some of it, you know.
Well, now let me ask you this: on a movie like that, you said action was a new genre for you. How many copies of doubles, or how many like of one of John Wick's suits? How many copies did you have to make?
I think I have lost the track. I mean, I cannot even tell you, but I mean, I don't know, 20, 30, I can't remember.
Wow,
like, you know, it was like always. Because I mean, it's an action movie to a level that, you know, everyone is fighting, and you know, and things are happening all the time, and you have Keanu, and then you have a stunt double, and then you have the stunt double of the stunt double, and then you have the guy who has to jump from a window, and then you have the guy who has to drive a car, and Keanu makes a lot of his own stunts. You know, he's very, very, very well known for doing a lot of his stunt work, or I would say most of it. And it was always like, you know, I had the people on set always calling me and screaming, we are running out of suits. Everything has holes now, you know. And then, I mean, you know, I can't remember. We have a tailor almost like making the costumes for him all the time, like repeating and making repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats.
Well, I'm looking so forward to that. Well, listen, before we end the interview, let me ask you, a lot of people that watch Designing Hollywood are up and coming designers or people that want to get into the industry. What advice can you give to people that are just starting out? They want to get into costume design, or they want to get into production design. What can you tell them they should concentrate on?
Well, I would say, like, it's super important to be yourself, being open to opportunities. Think that no job is a bad job. Every job will bring you something, or some of them will bring you knowledge. Some of them will bring you links with another friend. Some of them will bring you money. I mean, that's important too. And some of them will help you to advance as a designer. And this is a very important thing. But almost I would say that it's very important to make connections with people that you feel that understands you, and that you understand them, and you can create, especially I think at the beginning, it's very important to create a community of fellow colleagues, friends, people with the same interests as you, and start doing work together. You know, it can be something that you can make with an iPhone, or something you can make just in the corner of a cafe, just like speaking to each other. Or, you know, I mean, I think it's very, very, very different ways to get into cinema. Not, I mean, in my case, was that I said to you, strikes of luck. I always think, but it's very, very many ways to. And the other thing I always say, this is not a sprint, a race. It's a marathon.
Yes.
And you have to think that it's a long, long distance course, and you might think that you are not getting there, or you're not getting where you want to, and then one day suddenly you realize that yes, you are doing what you want, doing what you love, and being happy with it, you know.
Well, this has been so great, Paco. I very much appreciate your time. Do you have a social media presence? Can people follow you on, say, Instagram?
Well, I have Facebook, but I have decided to stop using it like a couple of years ago. I have an Instagram, but I never use it.
Okay.
I never put anything. I'm really crap. I don't know. I mean, I'm now more into, because, I mean, the thing is, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that, but I just think that all this social media, what it makes at the end is to give you a lot of a world of insatisfaction that you are living the life of others when you should be living the life of yourself.
Right.
It's a very interesting sentence by Oscar Wilde that says, "Be yourself. Every other person is already." Believed, you know, then I think that's super important. It's not that I'm against them. It's just like I think I got bored of them, you know.
Sure. Well, I totally understand that. Totally understand.
I'm now enjoying very much to read books, or, you know, I mean, I'm going back to. I used to be a really, really big book reader when I was young, and then. Because the career, and, you know, because you never have got time, and you start like running and everything. But lately, I lost my mom last year, and it just made me feel that there are very, very many important things in life that you shouldn't abandon. And one of them is to read, for example, to get back to reading.
I completely agree. Do you have favorite authors?
I have very, very many different. I mean, I love to read, because I love gossiping. I love to read books based on letters, epistles. You know, like like letters of people sending letters to each other. You know, the letters of Klimt or you know, like the book of letters of Madame de Sévigné. All these sort of things I really, really enjoy. I mean, but now I'm reading a book about one of the last kings of Poland, Stanislaw Poniatowski, and written by an amazing Mexican writer that she was one of her descendants, Elena Poniatowska.
Wow.
And then it's is really, you know, I'm enjoying it a lot. It's really interesting. I love it. I love especially English literature and Spanish or Hispano, you know, Hispano America literature. The problem with books is so many things to read. You know?
I know.
I'm not a big reader, for example, of Russian books, and I always regret it because I really recently read The Idiot, Dostoevsky, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought, my God, how could I spend so many years without reading it, you know? And one of my dreams is to read War and Peace.
Sure.
But I think you need to have you need to be convalescent or something for a year and a half or something to be capable of reading it.
Well, Paco Delgado, this has been so much fun, such an honor to speak with you today. I want to thank you so much for being here on the Designing Hollywood show.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a great time with you, and I really have enjoyed it. It's always nice to come back to your career and just think, why do you do things? Because you normally don't think about what you have done or why you have done things. And it's always very good to dig a little bit into it. It's almost like coming to the psychoanalysis consult.
Well, this has been terrific, but no, I think you have a good head on your shoulders. You don't need psychoanalysis. But thank you so
much. I psychoanalyze myself quite a lot, you know.
Well, thanks so much for being here. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Paris Costumes. Paris Costumes has been a part of the history of the European theater, film, and television industry since 1856 and has become 21st century tailors. And as always, thank you to our guest costume designer, Jenny, for coming on the show. It has been such a pleasure to speak with her. A special thank you to founder and executive producer, Martika Ibarra, co-founder, costume designer, the legendary Marilyn Vance, and of course, John Campia from The John Campia Show. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tune in to the audio version wherever you listen to podcasts. I am, of course, your host, Robert Meyer Burnett, and you can find me on Instagram at RMBurnett, or find me on Twitter at BurnettRM, or on YouTube at PostGeekSingularity. Thanks very much. Like, subscribe, and give us your comments. What would you like to see on the channel? Right down below. Thanks very much for watching, and we'll see you on the next episode of Designing Hollywood.